Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, April 4th. Hawaii's fatality count due to traffic accidents continues to climb. We talk with the Driver's Education Coordinator about Distracted Drivers Month. We learn about the Motown of Jamaica from a local DJ with an encyclopedic knowledge why preserving music history matters. And we hanaho a recent conversation with a Maui journalist who's leading a nonprofit newsroom. Misinformation abounded after the Maui wildfires, how she hopes her staff can stem the flow of fake news. Earlier this week, we put the spotlight on the growing number of traffic fatalities, which is running ahead of last year's cases. 35 people died in the first 3 months of this year, up from 28 last year. April happens to be Distracted Drivers Awareness Month, and there's an event this weekend that hopes to draw parents and potential new student drivers to learn about what to consider when you get behind the wheel these days. We talked to Leilani Okuda yesterday afternoon. She is a driver education coordinator at McKinley High School. She spoke with us prior to a traffic safety fair, Operation Driver Excellence, that's to take place on Saturday.
As a driver educator, we see all these type of vehicles, bicycles, e-bikes. We even see the, a uni-wheel. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I know. I've seen it. It's crazy.
Yeah. And so what we teach our drivers is that, A, we have to take our responsibility in partnership with all road users. So the road users are pedestrians or the cars, any type of mobile equipment such as, the e-bikes and those unicycle kind of vehicles. And we do our part in looking out for them. Of course, they're more vulnerable than the driver, so they have to be extra cautious. So we teach them skills to have the right attitude and also to know the laws. And that's our hope that, they'll follow through, make it a part of their fabric as drivers, and try to keep our roads safe the best they can.
Yes, because new drivers, they're pretty stressed, right? I mean, it's something new. It's a new skill they're learning. And there's so many things to look out for. And now with the advent of these electrified vehicles, from skateboards to bicycles and whatnot, it's just more hazards on the road.
Yeah, you're right. And like you said, as a beginner driver, it is more stress and, their lack of experience on the road, they're just learning. So even if they pass their road test, that test is really testing on basic skills. And if they pass it, what it really means is they're a good driver for however long that test was. The real test is going to be once they start getting on the road, are they applying what they learn? Has their behavior become a part of their everyday driving? But, going back to these other type of vehicles that are new, for our drivers, one of the skills that we teach them is searching skills. So trying to look out for what else is on the road besides our drivers, and to really emphasize also speed and being or driving at a safe speed, and also to be focused and looking out for hazards and really being a defensive driver out there.
Yes, and nobody wants the trauma of a collision. And, if someone gets hurt, that's even more stress on the driver. They may not mean to hurt anybody, but you hold that for a very long time.
Yeah, it's hard to forget. It's traumatic. And I'm sure there's going to be a sense of guilt. What could I have done? And sometimes, it's not all on the driver. It's also on the other party as far as, were they practicing safe traffic habits also?
Yeah, you want them to be responsible. I mean, I know I was backing out of a driveway. I don't know, something made me stop. And lo and behold, there was a skateboarder who was sitting down, And I just was like, wow, I could have just run over this child. And it was very scary for me. So yeah, you want to spare our new drivers that trauma. You want them to have the skills to be able to handle whatever they come across, when they're on the road.
Yeah, and we're in agreement. We're both in agreement. And, again, it always is going to go back to what their visual search, what are they seeing, the thinking capacity of what should I do, and looking out for the space around them, is there anything of hazard, and really taking care of the speed. So even if the posted speed is 40, and if they need to slow down because there's not enough space, or, there's something in front of them, then they have to follow what we call the basic speed law and slow down to and adjust to whatever's coming from the front, the side, or the back.
Well, you know, many of these new cars are now equipped with cameras, and that is a big help. But not everybody's got a new car with those additional viewpoints. So I think it boils down to just good instruction. And I still remember my driver's ed teacher, Mr. Bilotti, and, you know, he went above and beyond what they teach in the class. He taught us how to change a tire. I have fond memories of my driver's ed teacher.
Oh, that's great. All of our driver instructors, we do our best to teach them safe driving skills, to have the right attitude. And, you know, like yourself, depending on what they teach, if they're an auto shop teacher, sometimes they'll go over and beyond and teach about tire safety and so forth also.
Well, you have an event coming up this weekend. What should our listeners know?
Yes, we'd like to encourage parents and teens to come out to our Driver Excellence and Traffic Fair, which is going to be held this Saturday from 9 to 1 o'clock out at Waipahu High School. You know, the ultimate goal is to, of course, lower traffic-related crashes in the state. And how we aim to do that is to prepare the teens to be safe and responsible. At this event, there's going to be exhibitors, vendors, providing interactive learning stations. So one of the keys there is going to be the unique situation of a driving course where parents and teens together in their vehicle will learn about emergency braking system, safe driving skills, and collision avoidance. And I'm not sure if I mentioned that we have a guest speaker, or two guest speakers that are going to present there. One is a former police officer. So they'll talk about how to interact with a police officer in case they get pulled over. And, you know, it can be intimidating for drivers. So they'll get to hear and also ask questions at that time. And the other speaker will be from an organization called TYRED, so TYRED. And that organization stands for Tyler, Raising Education for Drowsy Driving. So not enough is talked about for drowsy driving. And you know, I believe that speaker and that booth will enlighten parents and teens about driving drowsy or if they're tired and so forth. So, you know, we have many things going on Saturday at this event. And, you know, you don't have to be in a driver education program. This is one of our ways to reach out outside of just our classes and into the community. And, you know, if they're 18 and under, some teens, they don't come to our program. Instead, they're going to wait until they're 18 to drive. You know, we encourage those teens and their parents to come because they might not get the same type of information that is needed to assure that they're safe drivers. So you know, we'd like the parents and teens to come out, especially parents, to come with their teens because they are the role models. You know, sometimes we have parents who might feel that, I don't know how to teach my teen how to drive, so I'll let them go through the course. But what they don't realize is they're actually the role model for teaching because majority of the time their teen is watching how they drive. And you know that if my dad or my mom can drive safely with one hand and so forth, you know, they might feel that it's okay to in the future. So you know, it's a learning opportunity for parents and teens and also to strengthen that relationship because there's also lessons of life that, you know, our instructors and parents can teach teens. So it's always a learning experience. So we encourage them to come on out to Waipahu.
All right. And that's free, open to the public. But yeah, parents, grandparents, they can bring their young drivers to experience what you've got to offer there.
Yes. You know, for the driving courses, they need to have a permit. But for those that are perhaps still applying for their permit, and it's also a good opportunity to come out and pick up that information and learn and interact with any of our exhibitors and our driving instructors.
And what's the time?
9 o'clock. So yeah, so they can come on out by 8:45, 8:30. Okay. You know, we should be set up for them to come and register. We already have some teens who registered through the driver education program, but we welcome those who are not part of the driver education program, who are going to be signing up for our classes, or like I said, who may not be in a driver education program and, you know, for whatever reason, they're going to just wait until they turn 18 and bypass the program.
Is there anything that's being offered for neighbor islands?
Yeah, that's a great question. On Hawaii Island, some of the high schools put on their own traffic fair, and we hope one day, you know, there's traffic fairs on all of the neighbor islands. But right now, for this event, this is just on Oahu. And sometimes we have teens who will fly in with their parents to experience that, and we welcome them to come down. That's a great discussion point that I'll take back to our program. And, you know, shout out to our sponsors,
so
Dietrich Insurance and PAR Hawaii. Without them, you know, we can't put on this type of event. So we really, really thank them for their support, and Dietrich Hawaii, of course, who's been supporting us for many, many years. You know, I'd like to also thank, if I may, our driver educators who are coming out to work the event, and also to Jan Mikra-Sevilla, our resource teacher from the Hawaii DOE for driver and traffic safety. She's always in the background and, you know, not wanting to take credit for anything, but she's really the force behind this.
Yes, kudos to all the people who helped to put this worthwhile event on. We've been hearing from McKinley High School Driver Education Coordinator Leilani Okuda talking about a traffic safety fair that will be held Saturday morning at Waipahu High School. This is the 33rd year that the Distracted Driver event has been held. Look for links about it on our website later today. A local DJ has been making waves with a new guide to the music of a record label that's been called the Motown of Jamaica. Morgan Nixon, who goes by the DJ name Mo Man, has been documenting the history of the Jamaican reggae label Studio One. His newest book, No Man is an Island Volume 2, highlights 171 pressings from the label and provides notes on how to incorporate them into a DJ set. The Manoa resident recently stopped by our studios and spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about the importance of preserving musical history.
My family, since 1939, has volunteered for the Library of Congress's American Folklife Center. My grandpa started doing it in the late 30s. Then my parents were active in it, and so I continue that family tradition. I'm very proud of that. And I realized I was studying there for years because my grandpa recorded a significant amount of material, like traveling through the U.S. in the early 30s and throughout, even into the 40s. And it's a really interesting project. It was called the Radio Research Project, and he did it with Alan Lomax and Arthur Miller, you know, the playwright.
Yeah.
It was his first job. So there's a lot of really interesting roots to my work there. And when I first started researching at the center, researching my grandfather's contributions, I spent a lot of time there at the Library of Congress. And I was also studying American R&B music, blues music, folk music, whatever I could listen to, really. And I realized they had a serious gap in Polynesian music. I proposed filling that gap. And my original plan was to come to Hawaii for a month and record traditional Hawaiian field recordings. Then I was going to go to Tahiti for a month after that because they had a serious lack of both locations' music. So I came here, and one of my friends, her mom lived back roads Waimanalo. So I called her and was like, do you know anywhere I could rent a room for a month? And she was like, I have one. And I was recording jam sessions pretty much on the east side of the island. And then I met my wife, and we fell in love. And I ended up getting shipwrecked, you could say. So I was only supposed to be here for a month. Now I've been here 15 years.
It's funny how that works out. And that also explains a little bit this through line in your now writing career, which is documenting things like putting an archival flair to music that's been out there. So maybe talk a bit more about why collecting and archiving some of this work is important in your mind.
I've noticed that there's a 60-year cycle for music. Once it starts to get into that 60-year range and above, it gets listened to less and less. Like, you know, the 30s blues had a resurgence in the 60s and it became popular. And then through the 90s and 2000s, people are listening to it, but less and less people are listening to it. So a lot of the music in these books is like hitting that 60-year cycle where it's going to start to be forgotten about. And I'm a really optimistic person, but I just don't notice a lot of younger people listening to the music. And I think it's not because they think it's bad music. It's just it's over 60 years old. Mm. So I think it's at pretty like a critical juncture for like I'm 42 for people my age to document the music that we've been DJing and grew up on. Because if it doesn't happen now, it's probably not going to happen. And it could always resurge again, but from my experience, it usually doesn't.
Yeah. Tell us about the history of this music. And for someone who's never heard of Studio One, what that was.
Sure. Yeah, Studio One is often compared to Motown. That is a good starting point, like for most Americans or Europeans who have never listened to the music, because a lot of people got their start there. Like Bob Marley and the Wailers, Burning Spear, Toots and the Maytals, like a lot of the really popular crossover reggae acts all started at Studio One. To me, it's the most important Jamaican recording studio ever. It was also the first black-owned recording studio in Jamaica. And it happened right around when Jamaica gained independence in the 60s. So it's a very interesting like cultural flashpoint too. And the amount of music that they put out is like some people say over 15,000 songs. I've heard 17,000 songs is really only bested by like massive corporate record labels in the US, like Motown or ABC, Warner. So the fact that they did it to that scale with so much less resources, like everything, they printed the labels in-house, they recorded the music in their own studio. They had their own pressing plant by the like late 1960s. It's a pretty incredible story, and it really touches to just my love of like underground do-it-yourself culture.
Yeah. What about some of the pressings from Studio One drew you to this music?
Sure. One thing that's that I should note too is that the first recordings start in the 60s and go until the 2000s. So the label moved through all these different eras of Jamaican music, and Studio One was at one point based out of Freeport on Long Island, and then it moved into Brooklyn. So growing up like in Long Island in New York, it was prevalent. And it's something I noticed, like I started DJing in high school and thinking about what played best at parties and things like that. And I noticed that when I would go to a Jamaican dance or like a concert of some variety, like right at midnight at peak time, they started playing the Studio One stuff. So it really made me realize quickly as a DJ that this is some stuff that can really get people to dance.
Mm. Can I put you on the spot and ask
Sure.
you to talk about a few examples of those entries just to give listeners a sense of what we're talking about?
Yeah, no, it's okay. Actually, the first time I put a book out, people kept asking me, like, what's your favorite song from it? So this time I was ready on the third book. Like, I thought of it ahead of time. So my favorite song in the book is a song by the Solettes. It's called Dépendem. And it's interesting because it's based on a song by Smokey Robinson, The Miracles. In patois, like it's been converted, but the basis of the song is a Motown song, which I think really helps people relate to it too. And it's actually, it was Rita Marley, Bob Marley's wife's first group, and they recorded in similar sessions, Bob Marley and the Wailers and the Solettes. So that, to me, that song is like, if I only had a few songs that I had to pull out at a party, that would be it. But it's also really obscure and it's really hard to find. Like very few people I know own an original of it. So it has a really good mix of like something that collectors would frenzy over, but it's just a really good record. to DJ especially.
Okay, cool. And then, so that's maybe on the more niche side. Is there one that would probably be recognizable to a lot of people?
You know, there's a variety of, to me, one of the most popular artists, especially in Hawaii, is Bob Marley. So there's a variety of, I think there's five Bob Marley and the Wailers songs, and they started at Studio One, so there's some of their bigger hits. Like they had a song, I'm Gonna Put It On, which is a huge hit in Jamaica, and there's another one in there, Love and Affection, that was a really big hit. Like their earliest stuff, it's almost unrecognizable stylistically, like it's much rawer and more ska oriented, but then there's a later entry where they start to sound more like the 70s version of themselves. It's called Bend Down Low, and it's interesting because it was recorded at Studio One, but the Wailers felt like they weren't getting enough money and compensated properly at Studio One, so they started their own record label, Wail and Soul and M, and that's one of the first records on that label. So that's a pretty interesting one. Like, it's on Bob Marley and the Wailers record label, but it's actually like a Studio One record, sonically.
I'm thinking back to what you said of growing up in Long Island, not only having some of these records still be released as you were coming of age, but also having the experience of the clock strikes a certain hour and DJs know what to play to get the crowd going. And then coming here to Hawaii, where reggae music is so popular, you know, it's got its own portmanteau subgenre of Hawaiian music. And so what do you make of the cross-cultural and also somehow universal nature?
Oh, I love it. Because to me, it's rebel music. Like, it's sufferer's music, it's rebel music, it's equal rights music. So I love how it's been adapted in Hawaii. Did you see the documentary that PBS just put out? It's really excellent. And I learned a lot from it, like not having grown up here. I think it's super interesting how, like, it's mixed into the sovereignty cause and how people have adapted it here. It's very different, too, than the reggae you would hear out in New York, which is more, like, dark and minor key and kind of more menacing sounding.
Mm-hmm. I usually ask at the end anything else. I feel like I'll ask a flavor of that question, which is, what track should we be rolling out on?
A Studio One track.
Yeah.
I'd say the Wailers, I'm going to put it on.
Morgan Nixon, DJ Mo Man, thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was an honor. I'm a fan of the show, so I really appreciate it.
That was author and DJ Morgan Nixon talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. Nixon will be spinning vinyl records and presenting his book, No Man is an Island, Volume 2, at Ideas Music and Books in Kaka'ako this Sunday, April 6th at 4 p.m.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Merriman's Restaurants on Oahu, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Kauai. Details and reservations at merrimanshawaii.com.
Our next segment tips our hat to the changing news landscape. In the wake of the Maui wildfire disaster, some wondered about news coverage at a time when the community needed more information during a critical recovery period. Enter a journalism initiative launched by Maui journalist Colleen Uweche. It's partnered with Maui Now and its parent company, Pacific Media Group. We spoke with Uweche last month about the genesis of the nonprofit Hawaii Journalism Initiative.
Maui's at a really pivotal time, right? We're recovering from the devastating wildfires that happened in 2023. And so there's so many things going on, a lot of stories to tell, a lot of different perspectives from the community as we try to rebuild Lahaina and Kula, recover from all of that. And so this was in the works before that, but the timing worked out well because now we really need something like this where we're doing more stories, more in depth. And to tell you a little about it, so we're a nonprofit, partners with Maui Now, and they're run by Pacific Media Group, which is one of our big donors. And so what we do is we do original enterprise in-depth journalism. So sometimes a lot of stories that, you know, maybe we can't do when we're a daily news outlet. You know, when I was with the Maui News, there were some stories that get lost in the daily grind, right? You got to report the news that's happening, and move on to the next thing the next day. And so what we do is we take a look at the headlines and we say, okay, is there a story that we can go a little bit more in depth on? Are there unanswered questions that maybe we should tackle and address? And so with our partnership with Maui Now, I think it works out really well because they do a lot of the breaking stories and the daily things that are really important for people to know that day. And then, you know, we do a few stories every week where we take a look at something that's relevant and current, but takes a little bit more of a deep dive and kind of helps people understand what's happening in the news and maybe what do people think about what's going on. Here in Maui, the media landscape has been shrinking, and so we really don't want it to turn into a news desert where we don't have enough news outlets to cover the island at a super important and critical time. And so, you know, HJI's goal is to keep local journalism alive and keep employing local journalists. And I think that's especially important on neighbor islands because a lot of people on neighbor islands do tend to feel like either, you know, news in general or the legislature and a lot of attention is focused on Oahu where the majority of the population is. But there's a lot of things that deserve reporting or might get overlooked on neighbor islands. And so I think it's really important to have outlets like us, like HJI and other organizations that are doing good work on neighbor islands to report stories there.
Yes. And during this recovery period with Maui, like you said, there's so much going on. There's just stories everywhere.
Absolutely. You know, I think the more stories, the better. The more journalists we have with boots on the ground, the better. You know, I think because what we saw after the fire, there was so much attention on Maui, in Hawaii, right? We had a lot of national news outlets that came here, did a lot of stories, and there's a lot of tension, and they slowly have kind of gone away. And I think it's good that there's lots of national tension. It meant a lot of donations and assistance for people locally, but it's really important, too, to have journalists in the community who stick around, who are telling the stories as we go through different stages of the recovery, because we need that. We need people who are, you know, committed to being part of this community and understanding the impact it has here and telling those stories as we go through the different periods of recovering here.
Well, you know, one of our reporters was looking at the state of high school newspapers across Hawaii, you know, on all the islands. And I think she featured Lahaina Luna. But you worry when we don't have enough young people who are interested in, you know, what the facts are and getting the story. Because in these days, boy, it's hard to tell what you can count on when there's so much information or disinformation.
Definitely. And that was hard, too, because, you know, I go on social media and I see people share things and I go, wait, that doesn't sound quite right. And you Google it and you see just very quickly a couple of news stories that will tell you, okay, that's misinformation. But that's how quickly misinformation can spread. And even people who are very well-informed in general, you know, can be fooled by things that are out there. There's AI. There's just things that spread that we don't always know what the source is. And so it's definitely a tough landscape right now. And that's why I think it's great that we see, you know, young journalists who are interested in like our high schools, and they have the experience of the different social media that's out there. You know, they know how to connect to, you know, wide audiences and share on platforms that, you know, reach a lot of new people, young people, and try to get correct information out there. But it's hard, right? Like you said, there's so much information out there, and sometimes it's hard for some of the more legitimate voices to be heard in all of that.
We've been hearing from Colleen Uwechi, the editor of the Hawaii Journalism Initiative. Uwechi has worked with the Molokai Dispatch and Maui News and started the Hawaii Journalism Initiative to revitalize local journalism on the Valley Isle. You are tuned to HPR One, Hawaii Public Radio, and this is The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Let's return to our discussion with Colleen Uwechi, the editor of the Hawaii Journalism Initiative, a short-lived experiment by the Kauai outlet, the Garden Isle newspaper, featured two artificial intelligence bots as news anchors, and it turned heads last year. We asked Uwechi about the role of technology in the modern newsroom.
I think the new technology can be helpful in some ways. We definitely use it when we're transcribing our interviews, for example, and it really saves a lot of time. And so I think the news industry is in this really interesting time right now where we're trying to figure out how do we best use the technology that's out there but still create original ethical journalism that's well-informed and doesn't deceive people. And it's important to have organizations like HJI and local journalists out there who continue to produce these stories that people can trust. They know who it comes from. They see these people in the community. They see us talking to people. And I think it's important to have that human element, even in this world of AI and a lot of different technology. It's important to have that human element and people know where their stories are coming from.
Is there anything else you want to let our listeners know as they navigate through these different media outlets that are popping up here? Anything you want to underscore about the journalism initiative?
I think it's really good to see all these organizations popping up, right? Because we're seeing a lot of legacy media that's having to adapt and figure out how to remain relevant. And then we're seeing new organizations like HEI and Overstory being created. And I think that's a great thing because even though, you know, technically all these news outlets are competitors, we're looking for funding and there's a limited pool sometimes, you know, locally. I think it's good to have more eyes, more boots on the ground, more people who care about things that are happening in our communities and keeping an eye on government, keeping an eye on recovery in Lahaina and all the important things that are happening, you know, for us here. So I think it's great to see that people are continuing to tell stories and let people know what's going on. The more stories, the more journalists, the better, especially in these times.
And then you started publishing stories, what was it, last year, right? So is there anything, I don't know, that you folks are particularly proud of that we can drive our listeners to?
We started publishing last year in May, and there was one story where we took a look at the creation of the land trust in Lahaina, and it was created, right, to purchased land that was going for sale after the fire in hopes of keeping it in local hands and not having outside buyers purchase the land. And it was an example of the kind of work that we do because, you know, the breaking story is, hey, the land trust has been created, the land trust has purchased some land, and we did a little more of an in-depth story to be like, okay, what does it actually entail? And, you know, it's complicated, right? Because you have the land trust, which is doing good, important work of trying to keep the land in local hands. And then you also have people who are selling, who are feeling conflicted about putting up their land for sale and worrying about it falling into outside hands. But they are also saying, hey, it's hard for us to afford a mortgage. So those are the kind of stories that we think are really important to tell, is the complicated perspectives of the recovery. You know, we've also talked about, you know, as we build back Lahaina, you know, should we bury all of our power lines? Because that was the thing that caused the fire. But it's a very difficult conversation to have because if we do that, it's going to slow down our recovery. So the question was, what's more important, building back more quickly or burying all these lines so something like this doesn't happen again? And we've done a lot of stories related to the recovery about businesses struggling to come back, about, you know, homeowners in Kula who are running into struggles with their wastewater systems when it comes to rebuilding, the impacts on jobs, you know, the fishing industry being impacted, the tourism industry being impacted, but construction jobs going up. But we've also done a lot of coverage that's not related to the fire as well. You know, one of our reporters, Rob, did a great story about how, looking at the fact that more than half of our high school graduates in public schools locally are choosing different options other than college after graduation. And he took a look at the trends that are driving that. You know, we had the pandemic, we had the fire. And so there's a lot of things that are changing kids' minds about what comes next for them after high school. You know, one thing I did want to say is that we are completely donor funded. So we definitely rely on community support to keep us going as a nonprofit. And we have so appreciated the support we've had up to this point, the donors who, you know, have given us money, who've been, you know, supportive and, you know, really cared about our mission. We're so appreciative of the work and help they've given us so far. And so I just want to ask if people can continue to support, you know, local journalism organizations like us. We rely on that donor funding to keep going and doing stories like this.
All right. Well, Colleen Owetche, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Catherine. I appreciate it.
And that was Colleen Owetche, editor of the Hawaii Journalism Initiative. You can read the coverage at hjinow.org.